Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Kia ora, g'day, and welcome to the History of Aotearoa New Zealand. Episode 128. What's a Europe? This podcast is recorded in Te Whanganui a Tara, on the rohe of Muaupoko, Taranaki Whānui, Te Ati Awa, and Ngāti Toa Rangatira. We are generously supported by our amazing patrons, such as Renee, Jim, and Nathan. If you want to support Hans, go to patreon.com/historyaotearoa. Whee! It's been a little while. Well, not for you, but for me, the last time I was behind the microphone was way back in December, and I'm now recording this in February. Thank you very much for your patience waiting for new episodes as I took a break over January. It was well needed, as I had been working on the podcast pretty much non-stop for the past half decade. But now, it's a new year, and we begin a new chapter in the history of Aotearoa New Zealand. Previously, we have been talking about Māori culture, as it was around about the time James Cook arrived in the South Pacific in 1769. If you remember all the way back to the very early episodes, we talked a bit about the three phases of Māori cultural development. The first being the colonisation phase, where they initially arrived in Aotearoa and adapted to the colder climate, losing some of the crops they had brought with them and having to find new ways to survive. This period went from about 1250 to 1450 CE. When people talk about the Moa Hunter era, this is the period they are talking about. This gave way to the transitional phase, where Māori were more finding their feet and transitioning from a Polynesian culture to something still connected to the cultures of the Pacific, but more unique, what we now call Māori. As such, this is sometimes called the Proto-Māori phase. This period is from 1450 to 1650, and is a period of huge population growth, and sees the rise of horticulture and pā after Moa go extinct. The final phase is the traditional or tribal phase, from 1650 to 1800, which sees even more reliance on horticulture. And this phase is what the majority of the last 100 episodes have been about. Now, there are some problems with using this three-phase structure, as it is a bit too broad. For example, conditions in the North and South Islands were very different. horticulture never really took off in the south like it did in the north, instead relying more on nomadic hunting. So those dates and phases don't exactly align very well for Te Wai Pounamu in the same way that they do for Te Ika a Māui. With those caveats in mind, it does give us a general overview. With that chapter now behind us, to continue our story, we need to leave the indigenous Māori on their island home, at least for the time being, and instead shift our focus to a massive continent half a world away, which the locals called Europe. This continent and its inhabitants will play a huge role in the rest of our tale, thrusting the southern archipelago onto the international stage of empire. Which, if you had no previous knowledge of New Zealand history before this podcast, you probably could have guessed this based on the fact I've been framing the period not as the Māori era, but as the pre-European era. However, as it stands in our story right now, Europe doesn't even know Aotearoa exists. So, in the following episodes, we'll be talking about how New Zealand came to be on European maps, and in fact, how it got the name of New Zealand. However, that story doesn't start with James Cook, or actually the British in general. And even before we can get to our main character, I need to give you some background context. Otherwise, I'll have to keep stopping the narrative to explain who various people are, or why certain events are happening. So, it'll be better to just get that out of the way all in one go. So, we're not going to go to 1769, we're actually going to go back in time a little bit, and talk about the history of European exploration in the Pacific. Because a lot of the reason why the European powers were sending expeditions into this great blue expanse centres around one core idea: Terra Australis Incognita. Terra Australis Incognita translates from Latin as the unknown land of the south, occasionally shortened to Southland. Or sometimes, they just called it beach.
It's just beach.
The concept of Terra Australis is actually a rather old one, dating all the way back to the 2nd century CE, with the Greek astronomer Claudius Ptolemy. He postulated that because the Earth hadn't toppled over, which is something they probably would have noticed, the distribution of weight on the planet must be balanced. Since the land and everything on it was, you know, quite heavy, he thought it made sense that to balance out all the land in Asia and Europe, there would be an equal amount of land somewhere south of the Indian Ocean. Eventually, over the centuries, this would turn into the idea of Terra Australis, a great southern continent. While this idea was well accepted as being pretty likely, for a long time there wasn't a way to find out if Ptolemy was right. The technology just didn't exist. That is to say, European ships just weren't up to the task of long ocean voyages during the era of the Roman Empire. However, by the 16th century, that was no longer the case. The age of sail had begun. Europe now had large vessels that were regularly traversing the Atlantic for the Americas, Africa, and Indonesia, at the time called the East Indies. But the majority of the South Pacific was still a large blank spot on the map. They knew something had to be there, and they thought that something was Terra Australis. Over time, the Southland went from being a mere hypothesis to a well-accepted fact. To the point where even Gerard Mercator, the guy who made the map that makes Greenland look huge, wrote on one of those, quote, "Land here is certain, but how much and to what limits is uncertain," end quote. Of course, all that was needed was to find the damn place. The first European voyage across the Pacific was by Portuguese sailor Ferdinand Magellan in 1520, at least a few hundred years after Polynesians had already done it. He wanted to open a new trade route to the East Indies that didn't require going around Africa and the Cape of Good Hope, which was the usual route that basically everyone used at the time. So instead, he simply went the other way, around South America. This resulted in Europe becoming aware of the Strait of Magellan in southern Chile, between mainland South America and Tierra del Fuego. After going through the strait, he emerged into the vast Pacific Ocean. Though, at the time, they perhaps didn't realise quite how vast it was, thinking that Terra Australis was somewhere out there. Nearly half a century later, a Spanish expedition went across the South Pacific from Peru, with the express mission of finding Terra Australis. This whole voyage was based on a story told to the Spanish by the Inca, where a chief sailed west and found lands full of riches, some of which he brought back. The story of how this expedition came about and all the issues they faced along the way is really interesting, but we don't have time for it here, I'm afraid. Instead, I'm going to talk about it on Patreon for those of you who donate money to me every month and make this whole thing happen. So if you want to hear that story and a few others that I've got in the pipeline, head over to Patreon and sign up to the $5 tier or higher if you'd like to give me more. Just to kind of spoil that episode for you, the result of that expedition was they didn't find any large landmass, but they did come across the Ellis Islands and some of the Solomon Islands. The leader of that expedition also led another in 1595 across the South Pacific, where he recorded seeing more of the Ellis Islands, one of the Cook Islands, some of the Marquesas, and a bunch of others. The chief navigator from this expedition also led his own one from Peru in 1605, which went around the South Pacific again, coming across more of the Cook Islands and the New Hebrides. The main reason I'm telling you this is to give you a general idea of what information about the Pacific was available to Europeans heading into the 17th century. But perhaps more importantly, who primarily held that information? Europe was relatively familiar with the North Pacific. Spanish treasure ships were regularly sailing between Mexico and the Philippines by this point. But the South Pacific was largely unknown, and that's where they thought Terra Australis was. Additionally, the story of an Incan chief finding a land of amazing wealth somewhere in that area seemed to confirm to Europe that Terra Australis was definitely real. And so, they spent enormous amounts of effort, money, resources, and lives trying to find it. Part of the idea being that whoever got to it first could end up like the Spanish Empire after Christopher Columbus returned from Turtle Island. That is to say, hella rich, and arguably the most powerful empire in the world. However, Spain and their ally Portugal were pretty much the only countries sending voyages into the Pacific at this time, especially voyages to the East Indies due to having a colonial presence there. That is, until the late 16th century, where a new player sat down at the table to try and win the game of empire. Or I guess in this analogy, he had a fist fight with two of the other players already at the table, and even when he was already sat down and rolling dice, they still had a few punch-ups every now and again. Anyway, this new player, or rather country, was the small, newly independent nation called the United Provinces of the Netherlands. Up until the 1560s, the region that we now know as the Netherlands had a complex history with its neighbours. the Holy Roman Empire to the east, and France to the west. Through some convoluted dynastic politics, the Netherlands ended up becoming part of Spain, and as such, ruled by the Spanish crown. A lot of just really complicated shit happens after this, which is way too much to go into here. But the main gist is that the Dutch were unhappy with how they were being treated by the King of Spain, and as such, decided to revolt in the late 1560s. Beginning the Dutch War of Independence, also called the 80 Years' War, because, funnily enough, that's how long it lasted. Approximately two decades into this conflict, the States General, which was basically the Dutch Parliament, officially formed the United Provinces of the Netherlands. Again, I'm skipping over a lot of stuff here, so please don't yell at me, because basically all of it isn't relevant to us. Anyway, the United Provinces are sometimes referred to as the Republic of the Seven United Netherlands, or just as the Dutch Republic, which is what I'm going to call it because it's a lot shorter. Although there was a war on, heading into the 17th century, things were actually looking great for the Dutch Republic. This period is sometimes called the Dutch Golden Age, because it was a time of great economic, political, religious, and social change, along with advances in science and art. Part of what kinda drove this was that the Dutch Republic was one of the major Protestant strongholds in Europe after the Reformation caused a split in the Catholic Church. You know the one, Martin Luther nailing his 95 theses to the church door, and Henry VIII pulling the middle finger to the Pope so that he can divorce his wife. The Dutch being Protestant, specifically Calvinist, was part of their beef with the very Catholic Spain. At the time, what brand of Jesus you believed in was very important. However, the Dutch's brand of Jesus happened to have a big advantage. Along with the Republic's egalitarian history, at least compared to other nations, it became an attractive place to go if you were a Protestant with some ideas of rising above your current station. As such, there was a lot of migration into the Low Countries by not only Protestants, but also people who were a bit more non-conformist in their thinking, or were part of minority religions, like Judaism. This migration brought a lot of really skilled and smart people into the Dutch cities. Those non-conformist ideas were fueling the Golden Age with advances in science, tech, maths, literature, art, and perhaps most significantly, commerce. Banking and the idea of stock exchange were significant advances during this period. The Dutch Republic, at this point in history, was likely the most economically powerful European nation, and was one of the most prolific in terms of colonization. In short, shit was popping off for them, and because of that, the Republic had lots of goods to sell, which could make them very rich. But it's kinda hard to sell stuff if you can't get it to the markets where people live. Like the physical markets where people go to buy food, clothes, and whatever else. And the easiest way to transport these goods was by sea. This resulted in the Dutch merchant fleet drastically increasing in size so they could trade their stuff with the rest of the world, as well as the navy to protect it, who also fought battles with Spain, or local indigenous populations, to expand their trading reach even further, or gain access to more commodities to sell. More ships meant more people to design, build, maintain, equip, and manage them, which became a whole industry in and of itself. The Dutch were, at the time, pretty much at the forefront of European naval construction, navigation, and warfare. If it had to do with the sea, the Dutch were probably the best at it. In short, the war with Spain was actually going pretty fucking well. As if to illustrate my point, in 1588, the Spanish Armada sailed for England to try and overthrow Elizabeth I, in part because she had been helping the Dutch in their war effort. Ultimately, the Armada was defeated, and this severely crippled Spain's naval power, which the Dutch took advantage of by taking over the trade routes that had been dominated by the Spanish and their ally, Portugal. Following this, Dutch expeditions were sent to the East Indies. The Portuguese had had a presence in the region since the early 16th century, and now that they were unable to defend their interests as easily, it was a good time to try and muscle in on their territory. The goal was to gain access to trade goods that they could bring back to Europe to sell. Specifically, they were after spices, such as cloves, nutmeg, pepper, and cinnamon, as well as rice, sandalwood, and silk, which were all items produced in the East Indies. These trade expeditions were generally quite successful in producing a lot of profit, which was obviously great. The problem with it, though, was that these merchant fleets were being sent by many different independent Dutch companies, and they were constantly trying to compete with one another, driving prices up in the colonies and driving them down in the Netherlands, which was fucking up the Dutch economy. Additionally, the formation of the English East India Company in 1600 was putting a heck of a lot of pressure on Dutch shipping, because it was very successful in fulfilling its mandate. So, in 1602, the States General decided they'd just copy the English model. What they did was make a single state-backed company by unifying the smaller merchants already operating in the East Indies, the owners of those companies gaining prominent positions in this new organisation. This company would have an exclusive monopoly to control all Dutch seaborne trade in the region. The merchant fleet would be working in unison to keep profits up, while also ensuring the economy remained healthy, instead of competing with one another for bigger slices of the pie, since now everyone owned the whole pie. But perhaps most importantly, just like the English organisation, they were empowered to take military action, including making treaties, manning fortresses, and waging wars. All in the name of protecting Dutch economic interests. In English, we call this company the Dutch East India Company, but the history nerds will know it by its Dutch name. Oh, here we go, ladies and gentlemen. Verenigde Oost-Indische Compagnie. And that is the only time I'm going to say that, because it's much easier just to call it the VOC for short. And this company was one of the most powerful maritime organisations of its time. In particular, there are two groups within the VOC that we're interested in. The first is the individuals who make up essentially its board of directors. Most of the major Dutch cities had a VOC office, called a chamber, and each one sent a number of delegates to make up the Heeren 17, the 17 men who led the company. The split wasn't even between the chambers, though. They didn't get one board member each, or anything like that. And so, it ended up that the Amsterdam Chamber, who appointed the largest number to the Heeren 17, pretty much always had a majority, and as such, effectively controlled what the VOC did. This ruling council was referred to in VOC reports as, quote, the High and Mighty, end quote. The other group was the one controlling the East Indies, who we'll talk about in a minute. Given the VOC was essentially a huge merger of lots of smaller businesses, it had a lot of people, product, and ships that it needed to find a way to effectively manage. And because of this, you might think that they didn't really do anything major for the first few years while they kind of got themselves sorted. But actually, they still got in a few good exploratory expeditions under their belt. The reason for these expeditions was that the VOC's preferred route to the East Indies was still to go around the Cape of Good Hope in southern Africa, after which they would sail east. Once they had travelled far enough east, they would head north for the Indies, which was fine, but that relied on knowing when the right time to turn north was. How would they know if they had gone far enough east, or even if they had gone too far? Well, to be able to know that, a navigator needed to calculate how far east or west they were on the globe, represented by vertical lines called longitude. This is where the crux of that problem lay, which was that longitude hadn't really been figured out yet. There were ways to calculate it, but they were all fairly unreliable or inaccurate. So the ship may not actually know when to head north, and as such, may end up going too far east and off the map. In which case, they would hit Australia. And I mean that in the literal sense, because they would often get wrecked due to none of Australia being mapped. This is where those initial exploratory voyages come in. If the VOC couldn't solve the longitude problem, and trust me, they couldn't, then they could at least give their ships accurate charts in case they got lost. In 1605, a Dutch ship charted the southern coast of New Guinea, and some of the northern coast of Australia, just across the way from it. And between 1616 and 1622, the Dutch spent a lot of time charting the west coast of Australia as they came round the Cape of Good Hope, heading to the East Indies. More expeditions were made to chart the Torres Strait and the eastern portion of the Gulf of Carpentaria. Further, small expansions of the Australian coastal map were made in the late 1620s, particularly on the northern and southwestern portions. It was pretty clear that from what they had discovered of the north, west, and south of Australia, which they called New Holland, that this was a huge landmass. Could it be the western edge of the great unknown southland of Terra Australis? Maybe, but they weren't exactly sure where the eastern edge was, so they didn't actually know how far the land extended to the east. Perhaps it extended halfway to South America, but for all they knew, Australia could only be half the size we know it today, and Terra Australis was still out there somewhere. It's also worth keeping in mind that the western and northern coasts hadn't been charted to the point where they knew they were connected. Given the information they had on hand, it was entirely possible that those were two separate landmasses. Whatever the case, the fact that some form of Australia existed at all added fuel to the idea that Terra Australis was definitely real. Alongside the expeditions to make sailing the Indian and Pacific Oceans safer, the VOC, in particular the Amsterdam office, made a concentrated effort to improve the maps of the East Indies to make them safer as well. All ships' officers were required to report new discoveries and inform them of mistakes in the maps, which would then be reviewed and new issues sent out under a strict system of control. The reason for that was more so to stop competing countries from getting their grubby little hands on them. During the Age of Exploration, accurate maps were like a trade secret that needed to be protected. They were extremely valuable. More accurate maps meant your ships were less likely to get wrecked, or your captains might take faster or more efficient routes to their destination, or you may discover that there is a route that no one else knows about that is better than any other, and that gives you a very strong advantage over the competition. I think I should also stress that all of this was not without some risk. Dangers sailing to the East Indies, or virtually anywhere long distance, were many. There was the possibility that the ship may get an adverse wind and be thrown on some rocks. Scurvy was one of the leading causes of death while at sea during this period. While maps were generally pretty good, especially in well-travelled routes, there was always a chance that someone read it wrong. And of course, there was the ever-present danger of the officers being incompetent or making a bad decision. You always have to account for human stupidity. And even if you made it to the East Indies, there was tropical diseases that could get you instead. While these expeditions are interesting and amazing in their own right, it's important to remember that they weren't commissioned because exploring is fun, or for the advancement of science, at least not in the case of the VOC. All of the company's expeditions were intrinsically entwined with the driving forces of the Dutch Empire, namely exploration and trade, which are, quote, woven together and woven on the frame of finance, end quote. Which is how the New Zealand Department of Internal Affairs put it in 1942. That is to say, these voyages were all about finding new ways to make money. To achieve commercial growth, meaning expand their trade and get more money, they needed capital in the form of ships, people, and resources. That capital needed to be resilient enough to be able to recover from failure, because sometimes investments just don't work out. Any investment, even property, has an inherent amount of risk. In this case, sometimes ships get wrecked, cargo gets lost or stolen, or people die. So they needed to ensure that they could replace those easily. Or if they couldn't, then it wouldn't hurt their bottom line. The best way to minimize this risk was to just have a shitload of capital by having a monopoly. In the VOC's case, this monopoly was a state-sanctioned one of basically any trade within the Pacific. However, a monopoly needs to be protected and maintained, else you'll lose it. And so security was also a major factor in the expansion of the empire. And a key part of security was holding territory to fuel the war machine. All of this is to say that the importance of the VOC in our story can't really be overstated. Their motivations are going to be what drives a lot of what happens in the following episodes. And although many characters we're going to talk about will be heading on these voyages for the thrill and glory of exploring new lands, these tales are unequivocally, undeniably linked to the atrocities of empire and the perpetually unsatiated hunger of capitalism. Please do not take my grandiose wording from earlier as admiration for the VOC. It is not. Once the VOC had established themselves and were managing trade throughout the burgeoning Dutch Empire, one thing they needed to firm up was control of the East Indies. Initially, the leader of what became the Dutch East Indies, the Dutch colonies in Indonesia, was de facto whoever happened to be admiral of the Dutch naval fleet operating there at the time. This wasn't a great arrangement because the admiral had no fixed location from which business or governance could be conducted. So in 1619, a proper government was set up headed by a governor general, located in the recently conquered Jakarta, which was now renamed Batavia. As such, this new leading body was called the Batavian Council. With a new permanent base of operations, the VOC's influence, power, and naval dominance in the East Indies and beyond grew exponentially. The VOC were one of the major territorial powers in the region, and often got into violent clashes with Portugal, Spain, and even the Republic's nominal ally, England. By this time, the VOC had massively improved its internal processes, establishing more formal procedures of promotion, an oath of loyalty to the Republic, and a more complex bureaucracy to manage its affairs. With this in place, by the 1630s, the VOC was keen to expand, and there were a few ways to do this. They could take towns from Spain or Portugal, giving them more markets to sell basic goods to locals and more plantations to grow spices to ship back to the Netherlands. But this was costly and risky, along with being somewhat at the whims of geopolitical machinations in Europe, since the war was a bit on and off over the years. Another was to send ships to find new opportunities for trade. Often, this involved heading to already known islands and establishing a trading relationship with whoever was there. Big open opportunities at the time were in places like Japan and modern Thailand. However, these were sometimes hard to pull off, such as in Japan, the shogun was not well disposed to Europeans and only allowed trade in two ports in the south. So, the other option they had was to find people and places that no one else knew about. If they sent ships beyond the edge of the map to find people they could trade with, or places that had rich resources, then they could get in there first to extract them for that sweet, sweet profit. And as it so happened, there were three employees who were pushing for just that kind of exploratory voyage. One of whom was Abel Janszoon Tasman, the man who would be the first European in Aotearoa. Sort of. There we are. Got there eventually. Next time, we will talk about Abel Tasman's early life, how he joined the Dutch East India Company, and his first major expedition. If you want to get in touch, my email and social media is on historyaotearoa.com. You can also find helpful resources there, like transcripts and sources. If you would like to support Hans, you can do so through donating via Patreon or giving us a review. As always, haere tu atu, hoki tu mai. See you next time.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.